You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the October 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of the Parkland Ground Game by Dave Cullen, with photographs by Paul D'Amato. The day after the shooting, Cameron Caskey began envisioning the big march. 5 weeks to pull it off. Felt borderline reckless. But by the time he invited Jackie to join him the next day, she was already organizing another operation with a fiercer sense of urgency. 1 week. It started with a Facebook post. Jackie posted it before going to bed the night of the shooting. That day, she had walked out of the freshman building 10 to 15 minutes before the gunman entered through the same doors. Jackie had organized a fundraiser to sell Valentine's Day carnations and delivered them during her free hour. When the fire alarm sounded, she was back in study hall with her advisor, along with some autistic students. They hurried out to the bus loop, and a friend said she'd heard a gunshot. "No, you didn't," Jackie told her. But people started running and yelling about a shooter. "I was really confused," she told me later. They had been trained to shelter in their classrooms, so they ran, suddenly frantic. "I had no idea who was behind me," she said. "It could have been a whole team of shooters. Or no one." She whipsawed between panic and eye-rolling. "I was in denial like the first 15 minutes, Jackie said. She had reason to be skeptical. Her mother teaches at a nearby elementary school, and she wasn't on lockdown. "I was texting her, and she was like, 'Relax, Jackie. This is not real. We're not on lockdown. We would have been on lockdown by now.'" Suddenly, Mary Corrin's text changed. "This is real. Active shooter. Just listen to your teacher." Jackie hunkered down in her classroom for 3.5 hours. She heard a helicopter thuck, thuck, thuck outside her window as she watched its footage of her building on her phone. Cameron Caskey was there, too. When the SWAT team came, they burst in violently, shattering the glass in the door. 5 hulking men barked orders and pointed assault weapons, hands up. "It was terrifying," Jackie said, but she was most afraid for the autistic kids. They were making noises, and some of them didn't know to put their hands up when they were told to, she said. If they had made a wrong move, who knows? Jackie and Cameron staggered home shaken and angry. Classmates took to social media, pouring out their ordeals. Jackie wasn't sure what to write. She was focused on her friend Jamie Gutenberg, who was missing, that ghastly euphemism for probably dead. She pounded out a Facebook post that said, "Please pray for my school," worked up to a call for stricter gun laws, and ended, "Make it stop." "The end of my little message was that we need to make a change," she told me. I obviously didn't know how. I had no idea. The next morning, she got word that Jamie was dead. Local officials put Jackie in touch with her state senator, Lauren Book, who helped her shape and mobilize her plan. The lightning strike on the Florida state capitol in Tallahassee just 5 days later. It should have taken a week or two to plan, but the legislative window was closing fast. Senator Book spent Saturday and Sunday cajoling her colleagues. As the yeses multiplied, so did the logistics. Jackie sorted volunteer students into 10 rotating groups to meet officials in intimate sessions. Senator Book compiled a profile on each official, which Jackie matched to students based on interest and personalities. "Strong students with hard-headed legislators," she said, Allied legislators created a crash course on lobbying for their late-night arrivals. Uber Eats and individuals donated the meals. Florida State University provided two sprawling rooms to accommodate cots donated by the Red Cross. Book insisted on paying the biggest expense, nearly $12,000 for the three buses, out of her own pocket. Many parents were reluctant to support it. Much of Jackie's weekend was consumed allaying their fears by cell phone. Tuesday afternoon, 6 days after the attack, three jumbo buses loaded with Douglas High survivors snaked up the Florida Turnpike. The eight-hour trek was live-streamed by embedded journalists from CNN and other outlets. The kids met with 58 state officials that day, including every member of the Republican leadership, Senate President, House Speaker, Attorney General, and Governor. 2 weeks later, Governor Rick Scott defied the NRA and signed a modest gun control bill into law. It banned bump stocks, raised the minimum age for buying a gun to 21, and added a 3-day waiting period. It did not address assault weapons. No one had seen that coming. After decades of defeats, the momentum of the gun debate had suddenly flipped. Jackie Corin gave her movement something it desperately needed. She gave it a win. Next photo, United They Stand. Speed was key to the Parkland phenomenon. 19 years into the school shooter era, students expect attacks to happen. This time they were primed for action. And in the photo, students stand in a circle, arm in arm. Cameron Caskey first tweeted hashtag never again 2 days after the shooting. Wasn't never again a Holocaust phrase? His friends ask. Yes, but so what? They brushed it off and went with hashtag never again MSD. But they quietly inched away from it in the days leading up to the march. We can't actually use that because it's owned by the Anti-Defamation League, said MFOL Chief Strategist Matt Deitch. March for Our Lives became the official name. MFOL was born in Cameron's living room and solidified that first weekend. The group initially comprised about 24 Douglas students and 5 recent graduates, mostly Cameron's friends from drama club, plus a handful from the school news channel and 2 others. Jackie was one of the 2, an implementer among the creatives. They would add about 10 Douglas classmates in June, followed by more students from around the country during the summer bus tour. They made 2 crucial decisions immediately: speak with one voice and hammer one topic, guns. Over these first 2 decades of the school shooter era, 3 major strategies have emerged to end it: addressing mental health issues, eliminating easy access to guns, and ending media lionization of the killers. All 3 are daunting, but adversaries have stalled progress on each one by deflecting to the other 2. The Parkland kids seem to have accidentally solved the problem of celebrity shooters simply by becoming bigger celebrities themselves. It took David Hogue 24 hours to become the first survivor of a school shooting to surpass his attacker in fame. Emma Gonzalez went viral shortly thereafter. Meanwhile, the gunman's name has already been forgotten, and few people could pick him out of a lineup. He is irrelevant, but his mental health problems may not be. In August, police released a partial transcript of an interview conducted within hours of the attack, in which the killer insisted that a demon voice in his head had repeatedly cajoled him to commit violence. Burn, kill, destroy, the voice said. The Parkland kids believe mental health is an important cause, but it's not their cause. From the start, they saw one road to victory: throw all their weight behind the problem of guns. According to the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, the U.S. averaged 3.85 gun deaths per 100,000 inhabitants in 2016, which is 8 times Canada's rate and 27 times Denmark's. At least 138 people have died in American school shootings since the Sandy Hook massacre in December 2012, as reported by the nonprofit Gun Violence Archive. Earlier this year, Russia was alarmed by a string of school stabbings, with some of the assailants citing Columbine as their inspiration. But nobody died. The difference? Guns are very difficult to obtain legally there. The Parkland kids decided their demands must be extensive and specific, yet reasonable. Above all, they pledged to keep their hands off the Second Amendment. They didn't want to cause trouble for hunters, gun collectors, or gun enthusiasts. But they didn't think hunters had the right to a howitzer or an M16. So they all dived into research. What had been tried already? What worked? What failed? And what did the American people support? What did gun owners themselves support? The NRA closely guards its membership data, but claims nearly 5 million members. And David Hogue is 3 of them, Jackie told a town hall in Denver. Lots of people like to buy us memberships. She always gets a laugh with that line. Even if the 5 million figure is accurate, it represents just 1.5% of the population. Yet the NRA's aura of invincibility goes largely untested, because politicians so rarely risk opposing it, even on trivial matters. Every wrong vote, even for legislation backed by 90% of constituents and solid majorities of gun owners, chips away at a legislator's NRA score and can energize a primary opponent. That's why it was so important to notch an early win. You have to begin to slowly build momentum, because most voters don't have a lot of faith in anyone outmaneuvering the NRA, said John Della Volpe, director of polling at the Harvard Kennedy School Institute of Politics. You need to believe there's an opportunity that you can win. It gives voters, especially young voters, faith. And the Parkland students, they've had more success already than many others have in many years. I believe that has to be part of their narrative. We've done this, we've done that. Help us take it to the next level. Della Volpe told me that in June, Jackie Corin had come to the same conclusion by day two. If we were all talk and no action, people wouldn't take us as seriously, Jackie said. We needed a critical mass event. Della Volpe was impressed by how these kids understood they had launched a generational campaign. Even if they devote their lives to the fight, they will likely hand the baton to kids who have not yet been born, he said. Just like the civil rights movement took years, this is going to take years, Jackie told me. The Columbine generation has been practicing lockdown drills since kindergarten, watching one suburban school after another attacked, wondering if they were about to lose the lottery. Year after year brought a fresh crop of devastated kids, most of them affluent, telegenic, and white. Meanwhile, students in inner cities were far more likely to die from gunfire than their suburban counterparts. In the month of the Parkland shooting, according to the Gun Violence Archive, there were 84 teen deaths in America, 5 in Chicago alone, and through mid-August of this year, 1,846 have been killed or injured, many in the inner cities. Their stories rarely made the evening news. It bothered the Parkland kids that a far larger cohort of kids facing far worse odds were being ignored, so they decided to join forces with them. Chicago was ground zero in the urban gun wars. In early March, a small group of student activists flew from Chicago to meet the MFOL kids at Emma Gonzalez's house. When I first got there, it was a gated community, and I thought it was a hotel resort or something, Alex King said. And then I saw the house. There was like this big glass window that was also a door, and I was like, wow, okay. When I actually got in there, Emma came around the corner running, hugging everyone. It was just like happy faces all around the room. As the groups got to know each other, they learned that their fears were different. Suburban kids tend to fear gunmen bursting into their schools. Urban kids fear gunfire and rout. Swapping gun stories got pretty intense, and during a break, Emma chatted with D'Angelo McDade about turning suffering into action. That reminded him of something. D'Angelo and Alex were representing the Peace Warriors, an interrupter group that seeks to resolve neighborhood conflicts before they turn violent. D'Angelo reached into his pocket and drew out 6 colored dog tags. The red one said Principal Number 4 with a peace sign. That was it. Martin Luther King Jr. preached 6 principles of nonviolence, D'Angelo explained. The Parkland kids were embarking on Number 4. Suffering can educate and transform. And King singled out a particular kind of suffering. Unearned suffering is redemptive and has tremendous educational and transforming possibilities. Sound familiar? Oh, wow. Can we do this all together? Emma asked. The full group reconvened. We taught them the principles, and they taught us about policy, D'Angelo said. The principle that most influenced MFOL was Number 3. Nonviolence seeks to defeat injustice, not people. Gun violence is the enemy. Legislators blocking solutions were a problem, and those legislators were adversaries, not enemies, and that was a gaping difference, not a grammatical point. Even if they had been corrupted by NRA money, none of those people were evil, and none of them deserved to be treated as if they were. MFOL was still developing its agenda for change, and the meeting helped shape it. Instead of talking about school shootings, they would address gun violence. The media barely noticed the distinction, but it was crucial to the kids. In March, they announced their 5 demands. 1, universal, comprehensive background checks. 2, a digitized, searchable database for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. 3, funding the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to research gun violence. 4, a ban on high-capacity magazines. 5, a ban on semi-automatic assault rifles. None of them was specific to mass shooters or schools. If people thought of them as pertaining only to kids, that was fine, as long as it was kids of all backgrounds. The MFOL and Chicago kids would meet several more times over the spring, culminating in the Peace March on the south side of Chicago, which would kick off the hashtag Road to Change summer tour in June. Nearly a dozen of the Chicago activists would hop on board for the first week or two of the tour, and 3 stayed for the entire tour. The MFOL team has been crisscrossing the country since Valentine's Day, attending high school and college events. All that local contact crystallized their Phase 2 strategy long before the march. Leverage the enthusiasm. Organize it. Early on, they noticed something significant. Every high school visit required a student to invite them, win faculty approval, and recruit classmates to execute the event. The simple act of visiting these schools was activating young leaders and giving them a taste of organizing. MFOL couldn't hit 435 House districts. It could not hit thousands more state and local electoral regions. The kids they connected with could. Every event, no matter how big or small, modest or glamorous, came with one demand: voter registration. A table or booth, or preferably a clipboard team hitting up the venue and the parking lot. David Hogue was frequently seen working the crowd. Their mantra was simple: you can't vote if you don't register. Young voters have long been a sleeping giant of American politics, because most of them stay home. If they ever turned out in percentages to match their older counterparts, they could swing many elections. Trouble is, they never have. Over the past year, however, young people have been turning out to vote in special elections. Harvard's Della Volpe, who has been studying young voters for two decades, says there are signs that this year really could be different. Young Americans vote when they believe their efforts have tangible results, he says, and his research shows that they are now 50% more likely to say politics matters than they were pre-Trump. Democrats are particularly charged up. In spring 2018, Della Volpe found that the number of registered Democrats between the ages of 18 and 29 who said they intended to vote surged to 51%, from just 28% in 2014. On the Republican side, the number rose from 31 to 36%. What's more, there are signs that gun control is finally becoming a viable issue on the left. The established wisdom has always been that Democrats don't vote on guns. Neither do most Republicans, but a small subset does, sometimes enough to sway a primary. This asymmetry allows a tiny minority to consistently defeat huge majorities, or to convince politicians they will. A media analysis published by The Trace, a nonprofit news organization that tracks gun issues, found that in the 3.5 months after Parkland, the number of news stories mentioning guns was more than double the number that appeared following any of the 7 worst mass shootings since 2013. And the increased coverage continued for 6 weeks, versus 2 to 3 weeks for the others. In late spring and early summer of this year, some national polls showed that gun policy had zoomed up to 3rd or 4th place among priorities for voters heading into the midterms, after the economy and health care, but ahead of immigration and taxes. Next photo, on the road, David Hogue confers with peace warrior Arianna Williams after the first town hall of this summer's bus tour in Naperville, Illinois. The morning of the March for Our Lives, early arrivals in Washington were enthusiastic but jittery. The kids had hoped to inspire dozens of sibling marches, perhaps even 100 or 2, but the number had ballooned to 800. Some true believers I spoke to that morning feared that was a strategic mistake. As the crowd formed, one person after another told me most of their friends had stayed home to attend local marches. Would that drain their force? All the coverage would hinge on the number of people who turned out in Washington. No one would remember how many people showed up in Denver. Denver noticed. The nation's 19th largest city drew more than 100,000 people, according to Denver's Westward Weekly. Colorado was stunned. Organizers were stunned. On Facebook, it was about 30,000 who said they were coming, and it jumped so fast, said Jessica Marr, one of the Denver organizers. Jessica was a college senior who had never done anything politically active in her life. Now she is the director of political affairs for Never Again, Colorado. The waves of supporters pouring into Civic Center Park and marching around downtown Denver on March 24th changed everything, This was real, she realized. This was powerful. The true main events that day, 800 sibling marches around the world, were largely reported as an afterthought. They were organized by high school kids and college students, many of them political neophytes who had never even voted. A massive national organization was creating itself in the image of the template forged in Parkland. MFOL affiliates now number over 1,000, Jackie said. They tend to like fangirl, and I wish they didn't, because we're just normal kids. But it's nice for us to give that to them, Jackie said. They've been looking at what we've been doing, and they were inspired by us to create something at their school and in their town. The summer demanded something big. MFOL could never top the D.C. march for national exposure, but they were focused on local networks now. The kids could see the impact they'd been having, energizing schools all spring, usually traveling in small groups of two or three. What if they multiplied that? They brainstormed for weeks and came up with a hashtag Road to Change bus tour. It was actually two tours, one across America and the other across Florida, hitting every congressional district in their home state. MFOL prides itself on being nimble, and midsummer the Florida tour was rechristened the Southern Tour and expanded to include Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. Combined, the roughly 36 members covered more than 15,000 miles from June to August, visiting 50 cities in 28 states and speaking to 50,000 people. They knew they had to go to gun country. Most of the tour stops are the places where it's most likely people disagree with us, Jackie said. The Farm Belt, the Mountain West, and the Deep South. We want them to show up and listen to what we have to say. They'll bring back that conversation to other people that disagree. Town halls were the tour staple. They typically wrapped around 9 p.m., followed by selfies, one-on-one connections with audience members, and dinners with local organizers. It was usually midnight by the time the kids staggered back to their hotel rooms. Then they'd wake up around dawn, drive 4 to 8 hours, and repeat. Halfway through in Denver, the Parkland kids were still in good spirits, but many confided that the grueling schedule was wearing them down. You eat unhealthy food, and you don't sleep properly, and your body's just always confused, Jackie said. But her big challenge was the logistics. She had taken the lead on organizing all the events. Whatever cornfields or mountains were rolling by her bus window, Jackie's head and phone were several days and thousands of miles ahead, arranging venues, permits, publicity, and speakers. She coordinated with local chapters to handle 1,000 tiny details, like T-shirt sales and check-in wristbands, and of course all those kids with clipboards registering young new voters. Every morning I wake up to anywhere between 20 and 100 texts, Jackie told me in late July, as she geared up for the tour's final leg. She typically works with 3 to 4 lead organizers in each city, and is juggling several states at a time. Each event is an undertaking, forcing newly formed local groups to work together. The key is building connections. Teenagers are sometimes nervous to make friends and stuff, Jackie said, so creating a network of kids and organizations that can help each other, without us being the mediators, is so important, because we're not superheroes. The MFOL team scours each city for promising young leaders. Every few stops, they coax one or more on board. They arrived in Denver with 4 kids they had picked up in Houston, 1 from Milwaukee and 3 from Chicago, plus 1 from Harlem they had connected with earlier. They give them crash courses in public speaking and other skills. For the first time, MFOL expanded beyond Douglas students and recent graduates on the bus tour, widening out to a national network, with many of these new recruits full members of the national team. At times, the tour got tense. Pro-gun groups followed the bus for 4 straight days across Texas and the one day in Utah. Some of the kids were shaken up, especially the ones struggling with PTSD. People had like 2 ARs, 2 pistols, 2 handguns strapped on their belt and a knife, Jackie said. Are you trying to prove a point? Because you look dumb. She was a bit rattled, but not deterred. The Utah group got some free publicity by frightening MFOL's Salt Lake City venue into canceling. We are getting a new venue. No worries, Jackie tweeted that evening. She had 3 days to do it as they pulled into Denver. A lot of venues reached out to us in the area because they felt bad, she told me. The other venue just canceled because they were scared for security reasons. Because we are security targets. We're targets. Before February 14th, Jackie's plan was to graduate in the top 1% of her class and then pursue a nursing career. I was on the road to getting straight A's this year, and I was going to, but I was on a trip for the Time 100 gala, and I couldn't take my math final, she said. For the first time, Jackie had to choose between academics and activism. Even after she skipped the final, her pre-calc scores were high enough to give her a B+. I was top 1% of my class, but now I'll be like top 15%. That's fine, she said. It messed up everyone. Everyone in the group is smart, and all of our GPAs dropped, because we just didn't have time. Jackie had 4 AP classes scheduled for senior year, but pared it back to just 1. I didn't feel the need or want to force interest in pre-calculus, she said. I'll look at the board in my English classroom and be like, this isn't helping me. Jackie hated that sort of talk before it, as Parkland students refer to life pre-attack. She kept 1 AP course, AP Government, because it's probably what's going to intrigue me, she said. Late in February, weeks before the D.C. march, she told me she was starting to consider a career in politics, a prospect she found startling, but also electrifying. Older people, they're listening to me, she said. I didn't know I had this powerful voice that I could use for good. Then she spent months mucking around with politicians. She was not impressed. I don't really know what I want to do, but I feel like I don't want to be a politician when I'm older, she told me in June. Politics is always going to be dirty, and I don't want to be around that environment. She envisions a nonprofit role helping improve kids' lives. She plans to keep up the gunfight for a while, but not forever. I feel like I work well with kids, she said. I quit my camp counselor job this summer to do hashtag Road to Change, but it breaks my heart because I'm not with my girls. One thing is certain. She's given up rushing to nail her future down. I'm learning so much this summer by just being present in these places, she said. Before all this, I was always the person who had my future set and planned. And now, there's nothing about my life that's set and planned. So it's a very different way of living. But the discomfort is kind of... She trailed off. I don't know the word for it. I've been getting adjusted to the discomfort, actually. That's a better way to put it. Because before I was always comfortable, and this discomfort is new, yet welcoming. When the movement was just beginning, and its future uncharted, Jackie foresaw a generational struggle. 4 months later, with thousands of miles in the rear view, I asked her if that vision had changed. I was just kind of thinking of all the movements that initiated change before, she said. It truly was generational. Though election cycles can change things, it'll take a generation of people to understand that they don't need these weapons. She has met a lot of people in gun country this year and heard a lot of them say, "I'm a responsible gun owner. I didn't do anything wrong." She understands that. But her generation, trained to expect a gunman to burst into their classroom any day, tends to see it differently. Her goal is not a decisive win this November and sweeping gun reform this spring. It's passing one reasonable law after another to reduce gun violence without cramping the style of responsible young gun owners. When they have kids, when they grow up with this all the time, and they've seen the positives that these laws will create from a young age, they will understand, she says. It'll take a generation, and it's unfortunate, but I just hope that when we have children, they will probably, hopefully, end up in a society where these laws are implemented and understand the importance of them. When Jackie, Emma, David, and the others hand the reins to the next generation, they want their movement to be more powerful than the NRA. That will mean many rounds of big wins and inevitably some setbacks. The first real test comes November 6th. Target Smart, a data firm which works on behalf of Democrats, released an analysis in mid-July showing big increases in youth voter registration in key battleground states across the country since Parkland. In Florida, it surged 41% in the 2.5 months after the shooting. Now, MFOL has to get those waves of new voters to the polls. They've got 1,000 new affiliates in the field, and the big task for the fall is building out a stronger infrastructure. So a random kid from Texas could talk to someone in Idaho and connect and organize together, Jackie said. When the bus tour pulled into its final stop in Newtown, Connecticut, on August 12th, they had 12 weeks to tighten up their organization for Election Day and 2 years to prepare for 2020. 3 days later, Jackie was back in Parkland for the first day of senior year. "The next week, I asked how it felt to be back in school. Oh, God," she groaned, "it kind of feels like an extracurricular." Jackie had apologetically rescheduled our phone conversation 3 times as she juggled calls with local affiliates. We finished 2 minutes ahead of her 9 p.m. call with Seattle. Before all this, her bedtime used to be 8 o'clock. Of the thousands of young activists Jackie has befriended since February, one stands out. She met Natalie Barden at the Teen Vogue Summit in June. Natalie was in 5th grade when she lost her little brother, Daniel, at Sandy Hook. For 5 years, Natalie avoided the gun conversation. It was just too painful to talk about. Parkland changed everything. She went to the March on Washington and was moved beyond belief, she wrote. "When she saw us do it, she felt empowered," Jackie told me, "because when her little brother died, she was 10. Natalie was Jackie's lead organizer in Newtown, helping her plan the 4-hour rally with food trucks, entertainment, speakers, and a meeting of MFOL kids and Sandy Hook survivors. "She did an amazing job," Jackie said. "When you have a connection to the issue, it doesn't even feel like a job." Jackie feels like she's passing the torch, but she's really lighting activist flames across the nation. "March for Our Lives does not belong to us anymore," Jackie said. "It belongs to every kid in America who is ready to heed the call."
Thank you.
The Immortals at the Gate. Inside the centuries-old cloak-and-dagger society that protects the purity of France's last bastion of tradition, its mother tongue, by James Reginato. Photographs by Jonathan Becker. Opening photo, Meeting of the Minds. The Institut de France, home to the Académie Française, situated in Paris's 6th arrondissement, and the Académie's meeting room. When you're known as the Immortals, as are the 40 members of the Académie Française, it's hard to take yourselves lightly. Over the course of 5 centuries, 732 of them have walked the earth and reigned as the guardians of France's most sacrosanct asset, its language. A linguistic secret service, if you like. They project an almost priestly aura when they don their habit vert, long black cloaks embroidered with leafy green botanical motifs, accessorized with elaborate ceremonial swords, drawn from the arts and academia, as well as the clergy and government. The Académie is considered to include the nation's finest minds, and is revered accordingly. It is, after all, the most exclusive club in France. In recent years, however, these august savants, ranging in age from a sprightly 60 up to 99, who serve for life after being elected by the membership, have begun to face some distinctly 21st century challenges, for starters, replenishing their ranks. Inside their temple-like palace, on the left bank of the Seine, opposite the Louvre, in the majestic cupola-topped chamber where they convene, a good portion of the numbered fauteuils have sat vacant for long stretches. 6 were unoccupied in 2017, while the Académie goes through its laborious election process. In May, it chooses its 5th living female immortal, and the 9th ever. Opinions on hot-button issues, such as inclusive writing, which aims to make French grammar more gender-neutral, have created a cultural stir. The Académie Française remains a unique combination of pomp and real intellectual power, a bastion in every sense, as I was able to witness 1 week in May, when the historically press-averse powers of the Académie granted me interviews and access inside their palace. The question at hand, could the arcane, archaic Académie be reinvigorated by new blood, attention, and energy? And just what exactly do they do? Next photos, Lofty Company. Gabriel de Broglie, Michael Zink, Hélène Carrère-Dancos, Xavier Darcos, and Jean-Louis Ferré in ceremonial habits, in ceremonial habit vert, before the Institut 2018 awards ceremony, and Académie members and guests in the Institut library. Since 1635, when it was founded by Cardinal Richelieu, Louis XIII's chief minister, the Académie's primary task has been to write the official dictionary of the French language. The first edition took 56 years to complete. A new edition is embarked upon as soon as one is finished, and typically requires decades of labor. Work on the 9th edition of the Dictionnaire de l'Académie Française, commenced in 1986, has progressed as of August up to Surhomme. Each Thursday morning, the 15 members of the Dictionary Committee convene around an oval table, as their predecessors have for centuries, and proceed word by word. "We'll cover 20 to 30 if all goes well," says one member. That afternoon, the entire membership assembles for learned discourse, and it's livelier than you might think. We have fun. It's not stuffy. We have discussions, not arguments. "I've never had to resort to the sword," says playwright René Delbaldia, occupant of Fatwa 22 since 1999, who will turn 100 in October. It is a pleasure to go there because people have a way of speaking to each other with such politeness. It is completely out of today's time, says art historian Pierre Rosenberg, the former director of the Louvre and Fatwa 23 since 1995. We are not here to stop change, says author Sir Michael Edwards, the only British immortal, Fatwa 31 since 2013. But to push language in the way of greatest eloquence, resourcefulness, and beauty, to steer it in the direction of the best French possible. Controversy can erupt along the way. Occasionally, the Académie issues public edicts, injunctions, and alarms, many of which are intended to suppress some pernicious foreign word, particularly an Anglicism, from gaining traction in French discourse. In its place, the members offer a more desirable French equivalent. Some of their efforts take root. Courriel is widely used instead of email, but many others, such as prêt-à-porter à risque élevé in place of subprime mortgage, just never catch on. Next photos, the old guard. Hand-embroidered needlework on Michel Zinc's Habit Vert. The medievalist joined the Académie last year. And longtime Académicien René de Obaidia, who turns 100 this month, at home in Paris. And then there's inclusive writing, a tough task for a language where gender is a central feature. French nouns are either masculine or feminine, dictating their adjectives, and the masculine always trumps the feminine. If one male nurse appeared in a group of 99 female nurses, they would all be called infirmier, not infirmière. The French High Commission for Gender Equality recently condemned this practice as a form of sexual tyranny. But to the immortals, changing the grammatical rules would produce a worse offense, a clumsy, inelegant, and ultimately less beautiful language. In October 2017, according to the Telegraph, they issued a stern declaration that just said no. Gender inclusivity leads to a fragmented language, disparate in its expression, creating confusion that borders on being unreadable. Faced with the inclusive aberration, the French language is in mortal danger, for which our nation is accountable to future generations. Many feminists were outraged by the stand. Other French speakers, too, have come to view the Académie as elitist and old-fashioned. Journalist François Bounet blasted the organization, likening it to a fat, blind, suicidal whale, stubbornly determined to beach itself on a rocky coast, with everyone watching. But the Académie still has friends in high places. In March, President Emmanuel Macron rocked the House with a rousing speech, the first address ever given there by a sitting French president. Grammar, vocabulary, etymology, and literature are the breeding ground where our lives take root, he said. A few months earlier, in the courtyard of Les Invalides, which contains Napoleon's tomb, Macron and his wife, Brigitte, flanked by former presidents Nicolas Sarkozy and François Hollande, presided over the grand state funeral of Jeanne d'Ormesson, a beloved author who had died at age 92 after a 44-year tenure in the Académie. We are here, different by age, background, jobs, and political opinions, but united over what constitutes the essence of France, the love of literature, said Macron, before he placed a pencil on d'Ormesson's tricolor-draped coffin. In the past few years, the Académie has been furiously devoting to filling its empty seats. After the election of the medievalist Michel Zinc in December 2017, this year it tapped novelist Patrick Grainville and philologist Barbara Cassin to join. The selection of the latter was particularly notable, as she is considered a leftist, even a radical by some, and, oh yes, she's a woman, raising the Académie's current female population to 5. At the time of the first female appointment, Marguerite Yourcenar, in 1980, President Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, who became an immortal in 2003 and remains one today at 92, sent her a telegraph in which he offered his deferential congratulations upon your brilliant election, which consecrates the eminent place of women in French literature. Later, in her acceptance address, Yourcenar said, "One cannot say that in French society. So impregnated with feminine influences, the Académie has been a notable misogynist. It simply conformed to the custom that willingly places a woman on a pedestal, but did not permit itself to officially offer her a chair." Less forward-looking was the election held on June 21st, when the membership gathered to choose a successor to the late novelist Michel Dion. Among the several candidates, the front-runners were Bruno Racine, 66, an esteemed civil servant who had most recently been the director of the Bibliothèque Nationale de France, and Frédéric Mitterrand, 71, a polymath, writer, filmmaker, and former French Minister of Culture. A nephew of the late President Mitterrand, Frédéric is also openly gay. The election of an immortal has been compared to the election of a pope, but with certain distinctions. Each academician is convinced he is more important than the pope, Xavier Darcos, chancellor of the Institut de France and an immortal, says with a laugh. The director of a Paris museum describes the Académie as a cross between the Vatican and the Jockey Club, referring to the poshest men's club in Paris. And like papal conclaves, the Académie can remain deadlocked for long periods. On June 21st, after no candidate received a majority of votes, Mitterrand garnered 11 in each of the 3 rounds, while Racine averaged 8, an election blanche was declared. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.